Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hello and welcome. It's Tuesday and you're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Hey, Tim, good to have you back.
Good to be here.
2 days in a row.
I know.
We're setting a new precedent, son.
It's like I almost have a work ethic.
Yeah. Thanks for being here with us today. This is going to be a great show. I'm always fascinated to talk about this topic, Tim, and we've got a great guest to talk about this with. Witches and Wizards, astonishing real life stories behind the occult's greatest legends, myths, and mysteries. And joining us from Australia, Tim, Lucy Cavendish. She is a natural born witch who created Witchcraft Magazine, the first magazine of its kind in the world. And she is a feature writer for Spellcraft. She appears regularly on television and radio explaining the craft. She is also a founding member of the Goddess Association. Lucy is the author of several previous books, including Magical Spell Cards, Oracle of Shadows and Light, Oracle Tarot Cards, and Spellbound, and the co-author of Oracle of the Shapeshifters. She's here with us this evening to talk about witches and wizards. Thank you so much for joining us, Lucy.
Well, thanks for having me, Dave. Lovely to be here.
It is great to chat with you. I just love this aspect of it. Let me get to know a little bit about you and introduce you to our listeners as well. Lucy Cavendish, a natural born witch. Talk me through that. That's interesting. I've never heard of somebody being a natural born witch, unless I guess is that part of your family, that that belief system, and that's how you were born into it?
No. For me, I guess I wanted to use those words in a way because quite often witchcraft is associated with ceremonial magic or a really kind of, I don't know, this sort of heightened secret society sort of vibe. And for me, it's so natural and it's so instinctual and it's really so embedded within so many people's DNA. And so, yes, the path itself, you kind of have to be taught, but the instinct for it and the yearning for it, I think is very natural to many of us. And I think I was born with that yearning to learn more about this path and to understand what was taking place for me. It's kind of, this is going to sound a little weird, but to me, it's kind of like a calling of the blood. Do you know what I mean? It's like your DNA kind of speaking to you. And so it's partly your ancestry. It's partly this sort of response to the natural world. And to me, it's just, it's not so much supernatural as a very natural way of relating to the world, and it's almost kind of a philosophy of living as well for me.
So, right. You feel as though this power was already born, and I use the word power as just kind of this natural aspect of your being. But you were born into this. It wasn't something that you had to chase or something that you had to get through incantation and things like that. This was just already a part of you. The force was strong in you to begin with.
I believe so. Yeah, that was my experience. And it was more a matter of trying to find a word or a path or a philosophy or a kind of training ground for what was taking place within my life already. So I was having what other people would consider to be perhaps supernatural encounters and strange circumstances or prophetic dreams, and this really, how to describe it, this very, very innate sense that I belong to nature or to the natural world rather than it belonging to me. And that, I think, really, it was partly born out of my family, but it was just, it really rose up from within me. And then I went on this quest to try and find a way of describing that and making sense of it and also understanding it, because sometimes when you're born a little bit like this, what happens is you're set apart from other people in some ways. Mm-hmm. And because of that, you need to find a way of describing it, a way of understanding it, and a way of making sense of your own being, especially if you feel like a bit of an outcast as a young person, which I certainly did.
What were the supernatural aspects of your life? What was going on when you were young that was just, you know, to you natural, but to us might have seemed like a supernatural realm you were involved in?
Well, I guess one of the things that was taking place was that throughout the evening, generally what would take place for me, not every evening, but quite often, would be this sort of altered trance state that would take place around about 3 a.m. most mornings. And what would happen within that space would be visitations from other beings or creatures, a kind of a whole series of visions, but they were also physical experience. So some people might liken it to poltergeist activity, for example. But for me, as a very young kid, I didn't have a context into which to put it. I had no idea what was happening. And because I went to a Catholic school, I went to a female-only convent school, I really was quite cautious about telling anybody about it, because I was already aware that it could be construed as something evil. And so I kind of had this tension in my early life between what seemed to be taking place to me but didn't seem to be taking place for anybody else that I knew. And of course it was taking place, you know, prophetic dreams or visitations or being able to see things beyond the physical. That happens to a lot of people. It's actually a really natural experience. But because at that stage I was in an environment where to speak about it was almost a little dangerous, it really held me back from communicating about it with other people. And so it wasn't until I got to about 13 or 14 that I spoke to my mother about it, and she wanted to take me to see a clairvoyant. And I really didn't want to go and see a clairvoyant because I wanted to make sense of it. I know it's bizarre, but I wanted to make sense of it for myself. I'm very independent-minded, always have been, and I really didn't want to go to someone else who might have a set of prescribed explanations for what was taking place. I wanted to find out what was taking place in some ways for myself. I wanted the comfort of my parents' understanding, but I didn't want their explanations necessarily. And I certainly didn't want the church's explanations. And I also didn't really want what we might call the New Ages explanations. I wanted to go back to myth and to mystery and to indigenous practices all over the world, and from those try and piece together what was taking place for me. So that's where I went. You know, I went to the old books, like the really, really old books, and I went to indigenous people's works and found that there was this incredible body of work out there that you weren't exposed to unless you went in search of it. And when I exposed myself to it, I began to find answers. And the closest word to those old practices was witch. And the closest practice within my own bloodline, which is essentially, you know, a little Irish, a little Welsh, a whole lot of other stuff just thrown in because I'm Australian, who knows. The nearest word I have out of my own ancestry is witch and witchcraft and that path of the wise woman, I suppose. So at that early age, that's what I kind of really connected with and began to try and find out as much as I could. And then I became open to other people's interpretations. Once I'd sort of done a lot of exploration myself, and I was very young to be doing this, but I'm quite strong-minded. Some might say stubborn. Okay. I really I really needed that context for myself, and I certainly didn't want the context of the church because I knew what that was most likely to be.
How far back does the term witch go?
Well, look, it's an Anglo-Saxon word, so we can probably trace it back to around about the 800s. And the Anglo-Saxon word comes out of a couple of other root words, and it comes out of the old word Wicca, which of course has a modern counterpart, but the old word Wicca is W-I-C-C-E, and that means to bend or to shape with wisdom. And there's another word which is word or weird, and that's where our modern word weird comes from as well. And these two words sort of got scrambled and combined into witch. And so to me, a witch is a person who works with the weird, works with the unusual, or works with the web of life and with destiny, and also works with natural energies in a way that is purposeful. So you're bending and shaping the natural energies around you for certain purposes, and hopefully ones that are full of good intent. But the word itself, you know, the practice predates the word, if you know what I mean. It's and that word witch is a relatively modern word, and it begins to get used really frequently once it sort of ended up in the Bible in, I believe, the 1500s. King James I of England made sure it ended up in his English translation of the Bible, and that really classic statement, "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live," was his responsibility. That so word was never in the Bible.
That's where the witch starts to take on a negative connotation at that point?
Absolutely, because the sentence that he was translating, which of course was from Hebrew, the word that he interpreted to mean witch does not mean witch, never did mean witch. It meant a person who murdered via use of poison. So that part of the Bible is a mistranslation. But of course, once it was translated into English, all the translations that followed throughout Germany, throughout France, used that mistranslation because it suited their purposes at the time as well. It was part of this incredible movement to essentially clear out old pagan practices and old healing methods and authorities that were beyond the church. So it was a kind of grab for power to put it in there as well. So, yeah, it's really frightening. But the Bible mentions a witch. The Bible mentions the witch of Endor. Now, that's a modern translation. You know, a much, much older word was used for her. But, you know, that's in the Old Testament, this story of this woman who was a healer and a necromancer who helps King Saul. And, you know, so it's really weird to me that the Bible includes this story of this very compassionate, very kind and incredibly skilled woman who lives in a cave. You know, she's in the Old Testament, and it's still argued about amongst Christians, like, what is she doing in the Bible and why isn't she depicted as evil? So it's kind of, there's a lot of paradoxes within Christianity and within the relationship to this particular practice and path, which is really the old indigenous practice of the British Isles.
You've got this title, witch, which suddenly takes on a bad connotation. Why didn't the practice try to stay ahead of it and change your names to nature maidens or nature magicians, something like that, so it just had a different, you know, I mean, you shake like the you shake the bad PR for a little bit and then reclaim it once you've reestablished that this isn't what people mistake you for.
I think that the dilemma was not so much people calling themselves witches, but of people calling anyone who healed or who worked in the old ways, witches. So it became a criminal activity. So it became, as soon as you were sort of tarnished with that word, it became a very easy way to get rid of people who in some ways represented a threat to the authority of the church. So, yes, you could call yourself a healer. You could call yourself just an old woman. You could call yourself a person who liked animals. You could call yourself whatever you liked. But if someone else in authority called you a witch, then you were in great trouble because they had the law at their disposal to essentially get rid of you. So I don't think many people were walking around going, yes, I am a witch. I think people really avoided that. But even if you'd called yourself a nature maiden, it wouldn't have mattered if someone else in authority had called you a witch.
Cast the aspersion on you. What's it like growing up with this interest and knowing that it's kind of this taboo subject? You know, having that around you and feeling that it's a part of you, but knowing that other people consider it dark when you know that that's not what the reality is.
I think, look, like I said, for me, it was really natural. And because a lot of this was done quite covertly, I certainly didn't speak about it with a lot of people. I was just that weird kid at the library borrowing about 12 books a week on, you know, the mythologies and the indigenous practices of nearly every land on the planet. So I did a lot of it, you know, kind of on the quiet. I read a huge amount. And what it was like to know that this was my interest, and it certainly wasn't the interest of anybody else that I knew at that stage. It wasn't too isolating because I grew up in a family that's incredibly loving and grounded and caring and not deeply my family were nominally Catholics, but they certainly weren't Catholic by the book, if you know what I mean.
Right.
My family was much more likely on a Sunday to be down the beach or to be going on a massive hike and taking us out into nature rather than literally going to church. So I didn't have disapproval from my family. They may have thought that I was a little bit odd, and I think they were concerned for me a couple of times, but mainly because they saw the impact of these sort of nightly experiences, you know, that I was having, or these really strange sort of trance-like experiences that I'd have throughout the day, or I'd talk about things that were perhaps outside of their experience, and perhaps they thought they were odd. But because I was a pretty grounded kid, you know, I love swimming, I love the outdoors, I love the beach, I love, you know what I mean? I had this incredible grounded connection to nature. So it's not, you know, a lot of people say I love nature, but they don't actually spend any time immersed in nature. I was immersed in nature from the time I was a very, very, very young girl. And, you know, I just have this deep connection to the elements and to the natural world. And I think that really saves you from being too concerned about humans sometimes. I think you begin to think of humans as being really weird and really quite odd. And although you want to fit in, you also don't want to fit in that much. As I was saying before, I was very independent-minded. I questioned a great deal. It was encouraged within my family to debate and to question authority. And we, you know, we had really dynamic discussions about all sorts of ethical topics. So my exploration of this, I think, was not so much encouraged, but understood and kind of given a very comfortable place to blossom within my family. I certainly didn't talk about it to, you know, the priest who would come to my school once a month. I certainly didn't confess to any of this during confession. And I certainly didn't really speak to any of the nuns about it, but I was very argumentative at my convent school, and my name was on the blackboard every single day. But being, you know, I was in detention and you know, doing all sorts of horrible, you know, tasks to make up for my ungodly manner at school. But I was a good kid. Like I loved learning, but I was like a disruptor, if you know what I mean, at my school. I was a disruptive influence, but not through pointless rebellion, but through endless questioning of authority that didn't seem to make sense to me. And I think what was bubbling underneath this was this cauldron of information and knowledge that I was exploring in my own time. And I also read all these books under the desk at school as well. We'd be in class and I'd be reading these books under the desk. So, you know, I'm very surprised that I got away with as much as I did.
What was some of the first indoctrination to this that you read and really started to take hold for you?
I really remember reading about the Druids' connection to trees, for example, and this sense that you could immerse yourself within the tree itself and that you could be part tree and that the tree was part you and that human sensibility and consciousness could move beyond the physical body into other forms and other beings. So you could work with birds, or you could work with trees, or you could work with sea creatures, you know, and kind of send your consciousness into them. And somehow when you come back into yourself, you're not quite the same human as when you left. So that, I really remember this passage in this book I was reading about this capacity to enter into trees and to become a tree perhaps after you'd passed. And that made this enormous amount of sense to me, not only from a kind of practical, pragmatic point of view of, yeah, of course, because you're matter and you're energy, and when you leave this form, you become another form. It also made sense for me because I was having these weird experiences where I felt like I was, you know, merging into, I don't know, stones, or merging into other beings from time to time, not humans, more other creatures and other forms of life. And it gave me this sense that all life was so interconnected and so wanting to communicate with you and so ready to communicate with you if you were just open to doing that. And that's something that I did perhaps incautiously as a young person as well. You know when you're a young person, you tend to take a great deal of risk anyway in life. I think I took a lot of risks magically early on without really knowing what I was doing, but somehow making it through, because it wasn't until I was in my mid-20s that I actually received any formal training. I did most of this on my own. I rejected it for a time as well, because not so much rejecting the philosophy of it, rejecting the practice of it for a time, because I was really quite desperate at one stage to fit in a little more. But that didn't work out very well, so I kind of came back to it, because I don't know how you feel about this, but I think that if you have these inclinations, you can run but you can't hide. They tend to come and find you in your life and reemerge in your life, even if you smother them with other forms of religion, philosophy. If you try and drown them out with alcohol or food or addictions, if you try and escape for them in conformity, they still tend to find you and emerge from within you, because you just can't run from yourself. And that's why I say natural born. It comes back to that sense of it's born within you. You can't run from yourself, not forever.
That's a
long answer, isn't it?
No, but it's great. It's intriguing, because, again, you hear that you're not somebody that, you know, there's this weird vampire culture where people are connecting more on kind of a gothy way instead of a philosophy or a belief system. And I, you know, Tim and I know people here that call themselves witches, where I think it's because it's more trendy and they like shows like Charmed, and to them, you know, the craft is their introduction to witchcraft, not the craft itself, but the movie. And it's kind of a more of a trendy source.
Yeah.
So it's always intriguing to hear somebody like you, who this is your life. You're immersed in it. It's part of you. It's not something that you necessarily sought. It was just something that was always there, and you just helped it to blossom. So I am impressed with that aspect of this story a lot more. What is the difference right now between witches and Wiccans? Is there any kind of real different definition?
Yeah, there is. Yeah, look, there's all sorts of different ways of looking at this, and a lot of people aren't aware of the history, but during the 1940s, and I go into this in the book, during the 1940s, there's a gentleman who was an anthropologist called Gerald Gardner. He's a great scholar, a British man. He became fascinated in the 1940s with what he called witchcraft. And he says that he met up with a group of witches in the New Forest, which is in the south of England. And it's a beautiful forest. It's very, very deep. And he said he found a group of practitioners who were practicing the remnants of the old indigenous path of the British Isles. And he worked with them throughout World War II to attempt to bring down Hitler in what became a part of this massive occult war against the Nazis, which is known as the Magical Battle of Britain. It's fascinating. It's this, you know, there's so much to tell about that story itself. But Gerald Gardner developed this word Wicca out of the old word, the old Anglo-Saxon word Wicca. And it became the word that became a kind of umbrella term for these rewoven ancient indigenous practices that he came across. And he, you know, he published books, he set up a witchcraft museum, and that's part of the history of it. But the term Wicca itself now implies that the person has undergone the initiations and the protocols of Wicca, as established by either Gerald Gardner or some other earlier practitioners from the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s. Now, a lot of people who call themselves Wiccans don't know that. So I don't call myself a Wiccan. As such, I'm aware of the protocols. I'm aware of the initiations. I'm not in complete, not so much agreement. It's not up to me to agree or disagree, but I don't vibe off of some of the protocols so much. I find them a little bit sexist, for example. And, you know, I just think there's a kind of association with Freemasonry with some of the rituals that I'm not completely comfortable with. So for me, Wicca is that Gardnerian or Alexandrian ritualistic approach to witchcraft that is a modern phenomenon. It is a phenomenon that is a kind of, you know, it's part of the post-war flourishing of new religions as well, you know, like psychology flourishing. I would call that a new religion, scientism, and also, you know, Wicca is a part of that. A lot of people use the word Wicca and witchcraft interchangeably, and that's okay. That's okay, because it's kind of, you know, people have forgotten the history of it. But technically, you can't really call yourself a Wiccan until you've gone through those initiations and protocols.
I thought it was fascinating.
Which is why I don't call myself a Wiccan.
All right. I thought it was fascinating around, like, I think it was around 2004, 2005, Tim, if you remember these news stories, they started talking about the fact that the churches in England realized that there was this huge upheaval, this changeover. People were leaving Christianity and joining witchcraft and making this kind of a mainstay. What do you think was kind of this, what drove this change, do you think, in people to suddenly start seeking information and of all places through witchcraft?
Well, I think there were a few things taking place. I think the rise of feminism and the kind of counterculture movement in the 1960s really contributed to this, because people were rejecting, you know, the conventional forms of worship, what the church stood for. The subjugation of women within the church was really powerful and had, it still does, influence our society hugely. And so people were searching for something that had roots and ancestry and that was real, but something that also gave women respect and really something that was perhaps a little rebellious in its form as well, that was spiritual, that was really connected to the earth. So if we think of the counterculture movements, you know, the flower children, you know, the sense that people were wanting to return to the land, witchcraft or paganism really speaks to that, that yearning for the land, that yearning for an immersion in the elements. And I think the rise of feminism also led to people searching for a religious or spiritual path that acknowledged the goddess, that acknowledged the nature of womanhood as being divine, as opposed to it as it is within Christianity, as being the source of the fall from the Garden of Eden. You know, you can't really get away from that within Christianity. It's a really tough, you can't write that out. So I think there's a really different feel to entering into a philosophy or worship or spiritual path that acknowledges and respects women, that also acknowledges and respects men, and that has this deep, deep connection to nature. That, to me, you know, environmentalism pours out of that. And I think there's a whole series of things that take place within the church itself, where the church shows an immense lack of sympathy for these new forms of spirituality and for these new young people who are yearning for something different. The church stands for the establishment, and the church has also endured a huge amount of scandal over the last, you know,
that's probably a good point as well.
The kind of scandals that it's weathering at the moment are really, really going to be tough for it to withstand. You know, in 2011 in Great Britain, Druidry was given the status of an official religion. And that makes perfect sense to me. I don't think witchcraft will be far behind. Oh, the other thing that was sort of, you know, hovering around at this time, there was still witchcraft, anti-witchcraft laws that weren't really repealed until the 70s throughout Great Britain. So you at the same time had a decriminalization of this practice because it was actually a criminal practice until very recently. So a whole series of things tumbled down, and as a result of that, something else could grow in the gap that was left. And I think people began to then feel safe saying, I'm really drawn to witchcraft. I really want to explore nature-based religions. It didn't feel as dangerous. And of course, that's what a lot of people love about this path, is they love the sense of danger that using the word witch gives them. They love that sense of the outsider or someone to be a little feared. That they kind of really like that. I don't really relate to that because I don't see it as a scary word, but I can understand where people are coming from. There is a revolutionary aspect to using that word and to wanting to stand outside convention.
Yeah, see, I feel like if Tim and I wanted to convert, I'm pretty sure we would not be as accepted into the witchcraft. So, Tim, I think we should just stick with Nature Maiden for now.
Right. Yep.
And then once we've proven ourselves, we can become a witch. We have to take a quick break. Lucy Cavendish, our guest. When we come back, let's talk about some of the amazing stories behind legends from King Arthur's Merlin to the infamous Aleister Crowley. And you had mentioned the magical Battle of Britain. I want to cover that when we return. We've got so much more in store right here on Beyond the Darkness.
Beyond the Darkness.
All right, we're back. This is the magic that is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Along with me, the very talented and skilled Nature Maiden, Tim Dennis. I like that, Tim. Nature Maiden.
What is my dress made out of if I'm a
Nature
Maiden?
Why do you have to wear a dress? Why can't you just wear a nice comfy jumpsuit or a pantsuit?
Oh, I like that. Yeah. A nice comfy pantsuit made out of leaves.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I like the, well, no, I don't like the look of that at all.
No.
Mm-hmm. This fascinates me. And I'll tell you what, here's my problem. Lucy Cavendish is our guest. That's not my problem. She's the best part of the show today. You know what? The whole idea of nature just icks me out, Lucy. I think that's my problem. I've got this disconnect. It's especially in Australia. Are you crazy? Why would you go out and be out? There are things that want to kill you in Australia.
There are many, many things, many bitey things.
Many bitey, squiddy.
That are all about us. Maybe that's why, it just doesn't bother me. I was out actually having a surf yesterday, and it's winter here. It's very cold. I had a really, really thick wetsuit on. I was out. You know, my husband paddled in, and I wasn't ready to paddle in yet. I stayed out for about another hour, and – you know, people are like, how can you do that? Don't you know there's sharks and da 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 da. But, you know, there's nothing that like that beautiful immersion in cold winter water to wake you up and to feel really alive. I just love it. And look, I live right next to a national park. We have 40 hectares here, which is a lot of land, and we don't see people for quite a long time, and a lot of stuff comes out of that forest, you know, natural stuff and invisible stuff too. And yeah, we're consistently dealing with, you know, living amidst what a lot of people would consider to be really inhospitable conditions. But we really thrive within it. And I think a lot of people do. I think a lot of people at heart, see, as long as they're comfortable, they've got a warm fire to come home to, they'll be okay.
Sounds like Minnesota, where we live, is the Australia of the United States, Tim. An inhospitable place where you can always find cold winter water, because winter here about 11 months of the year.
Minnesota's much colder, much, to be fair. You guys are very, very, no wonder you don't feel comfortable with nature. You guys deal with, 80 below with the wind chill factor throughout winter.
It's astonishing.
I lived in Fargo, North Dakota for a year as a 17-year-old. So I know, Minnesota. I know how cold
it gets. Were you on the run from the law to end up in Fargo? Nobody chooses to live in Fargo. That's like an accident.
I know.
Witness protection?
I loved it.
Wow.
Yeah, look, I went there as part of, I was an exchange student, this really weird kid, sent as an exchange student to Fargo, North Dakota, as a representative of Australia, which I wasn't a particularly good representative of Australia because I'm such an odd person. So heaven knows what everyone in Fargo now thinks of Australians. But yeah, I went there when I was 17. The best part of that was spending time. No, it was actually going to South. I loved South Dakota. I loved going through the Badlands there. Sure. I loved going, you know, just incredible landscapes. And, yeah, I had a whole new appreciation for snow. So.
Yeah, but you were only here 1 year, so I'm not real impressed with your appreciation of snow. After about three seasons of it, your appreciation will go out the window very quickly. The book is called Witches and Wizards, Astonishing Real-Life Stories Behind the Occult's Greatest Legends, Myths, and Mysteries. You teased us with the magical Battle of Britain in the last segment. Can we jump into that, or do we need to talk about Aleister Crowley or anything to lead into that first?
Well, let's just go for it. Let's just go for the magical Battle of Britain.
Yes.
So, look, there's a couple of really pivotal personalities here. One is Gerald Gardner, who we spoke of earlier. He was the man who founded modern Wicca. And another is this amazing mystic and really influential occultist called Dionne Fortune. And she and Gerald Gardner really wanted to make sure that Britain was safe during World War II. And so what Dionne Fortune did, she wrote a series of meditations. And she was this fabulous woman. She was very, very generously bezoomed. She had a fabulous chest, and she always wore masses of pearl necklaces and little twin sets. She didn't look like a witch. She didn't look like a famous occultist. She looked like a very generous bosomed English lady who was terribly, terribly proper. And she would write these very interesting meditations and go to the post office and post off each of these meditations to all of her occult colleagues throughout Britain. And then on a particular day, they would all focus on the tour of Glastonbury, and they would see King Arthur arising from beneath the tour and essentially sending out this shield of power all over the British Isles, kind of like literally an energetic shield that was going to protect it from, you know, the various bombs that were being dropped from even intelligence sources. There was this whole series of rituals that took place within the New Forest with Gerald Gardner, where he cursed Hitler and where he really worked very hard to try and bring down the Nazis. And it's said that they worked so hard during these rituals that several people died after them because their whole life force was completely depleted by the impact, essentially, of the ritual. So all of Dion Fortune's letters are available for people to read if they would like to. She wasn't alone doing this work. Gerald Gardner was doing this work, but so were a whole series of wise women, healers, old druids who were kind of working under the cloak of people no longer believing that they actually even existed, but working all their folk charms, all their folk magics in what's become known as the Magical Battle of Britain. And, of course, the Nazis, through Himmler, had been introduced to a wealth of magical practices themselves and were working magic in turn. So, you know, there's one level where this battle is taking place and all these series of battles were taking place on land, by sea, very real, involving the lives of thousands and thousands and thousands of young men. And on another level, there was an energetic and a magical battle taking place. And between the two, you know, the chips fell on the Allies' side, ultimately. But it was really, really an astonishing thing. There was actually a woman throughout this time who was arrested for her work because she was a medium and she was bringing through sailors who were killed to their parents. You know, she was operating as a medium. But the British intelligence hadn't actually released the information that these battleships had gone down. So people thought, you know, the forces thought that she must be a spy. So she was actually arrested and charged under the Witchcraft Act, and Churchill got her out ultimately. Her name's Helen Duncan. But there was all sorts of things taking place at this psychic level to try and bring down what were perceived as the forces of darkness. And I really don't know why someone hasn't made a movie about this. I would love to see it depicted.
Well, they're doing isn't there a Churchill movie or TV show coming out, Tim? Yeah, with Gary Oldman, right?
Yeah, Gary Oldman, yeah.
Is it a new series, miniseries?
It's a movie.
Oh, it is a movie. Yeah. I wonder if they'll touch on it. Probably not.
Oh, well, I hope so. I hope so. I mean, there's pictures of Churchill after being initiated as a druid at his family home in the early 1920s. And, you know, there is this really interesting idea that Churchill's voice was used as a kind of incantation to stir the spirits of old Britain, but also to stir the spirits of the people, to keep them really strong. So there's a real sense that perhaps he had some kind of magical training too. No one knows for sure, but we do know absolutely that he was initiated into the Order of Druids in the 1920s.
Fascinating stuff. So this power, now,
was Gary Oldman.
Didn't I remember, or didn't I, like, you'd know what I remember, don't I recall that there was a part of this story where they actually, the witches got together and kind of rebuffed an aerial attack that had been sent towards them?
That's right, that's right. And that was part of this shielding and part of the rituals that were taking place within the New Forest. It was, you know.
But I mean, like, that's legitimately documented, right? What happened? Did the weather kick up and keep them from getting in? What happened?
Well, if you listen to the occultists, what took place was that there was an energetic shield that was thrown up, and then the weather came in and a great storm came up, and, you know, the German Air Force could not cross the channel at that particular time. So, you know, there was weather magic being worked. There was this actual ability on behalf of these people, and I do believe it's a genuine phenomena that they were so focused that they were able to conjure up the weather, to conjure up storms that could, you know, send back the German Air Force. And, you know, that was a huge part of making sure that Britain didn't go down during World War II.
That is fascinating. That's a really intriguing aspect of the story that I always thought was really just amazing, that that this intention, experiment, witchcraft, magic, whatever you call upon it. But here's the deal, though. If that, you know, a lot of people will pass it off as coincidence. If people had that kind of ability, why aren't they coming forward, Lucy, in places where there are wildfires? I mean, we've done intention experiments on our radio show with listeners around the world trying to send rain to these places where the fires are bad, or rain to California where there is drought. And although it happens, and sometimes happens in record amounts of rain, it usually takes quite a while for it to occur. We don't know if that's ever the intention that was sent, or was it just nature's time to take care of things? How do you know the difference between it being a real intention and power? Because remember, Tim, we did that Colorado. They were having wildfires like crazy.
Yeah.
We had people begging us to do this intention experiment, Lucy, on our show. We did it and had people praying on it, sending energy, good thoughts, and trying to do that. And they got so much rain, it washed away roads, destroyed everything. It seemed like we had maybe overstepped. I like to just say it was coincidence, because I don't want to be responsible for that kind of damage. But then I think it was like a year later, they were talking about the drought in California. We started focusing on that, and all of a sudden they started getting record amounts of rain. You know, so and it was stuff that they hadn't seen in years.
I feel that this is, it's a very inexact science, obviously, and the energy which certain individuals can bring to these kinds of practices, it's not able to be quantified exactly. We don't even know who's partaking in these experiments sometimes, and we're not really measuring, and we don't really have a series of protocols. What we do know with the Magical Battle of Britain was that there was a set of really strict protocols that were stuck to with Dion Fortune's works, for example. So everyone would gather at a particular time. Everyone had a set of instructions that were very, very detailed, and they followed them. And she only worked with people who she knew and who she trusted. So there was quite a strong discipline brought to the practice. And sometimes I think, you know, I don't want to derail anyone's experiments or decry anyone experimenting with this kind of work, because it's valid, and I think it's something that people kind of need to work with rather than get scared of and shut down. But I think sometimes we work with it in quite a haphazard way, and sometimes we work with it with people we don't know. And sometimes, you know, there's a little bit of a difference between working with natural forces over an extended period of time and getting to know them very well. So if you're a witch, you know, you work with natural energy all the time, rather than just stepping in at a later stage and kind of going, look, I don't really know how the weather works or how it, you know, how it gathers, how it feels, right, but I think I'll give this a go. Do you know what I mean? That's a really kind of loose approach. And I think they had, during the Magical Battle of Britain, I think they had a very disciplined approach and a very disciplined series of protocols for doing this work. And I think that when the rebound came, because sometimes there is a rebound with this work, that it was actually the people doing the work themselves who sacrificed themselves, rather than creating such a storm that it washed away, you know, half the coast. Do you know what I mean? I think they decided to take any kind of backlash upon themselves. So, and I don't know many humans who are actually willing to do that. And I think there's also a difference when you're working in such a way to turn back a human force using the weather. And what you're describing is working against a natural force with a natural force. Do you know what I mean? And sometimes I think when we begin to tamper with nature against nature itself, we're not really in tune with it. It's very hard to express succinctly.
Right. So what you're saying is that messing with something you're not sure of, what you do is you may loosen the nozzle, but then you don't have the ability to go back and turn that nozzle off again.
Yeah, and you're kind of asking nature to do something on behalf of humanity. You know, there's a natural phenomenon taking place. You know, there's a wildfire taking place. There's a flood taking place, which perhaps might be a rebalancing in itself. So protecting energetically your nation when you're using very old traditions and practices that are in accord and in tune with nature may be a better way to work. It's a really interesting question and one that I think, you know, needs a lot of exploration before we can come up with any really solid answers. But I often see it here too, you know, when we have massive storms, people are like, turn back the storm, oh spirits. And I'm always really cautious with that because for all I know, the storm might be necessary for right. something, you know, beyond my comprehension at that point in time. So while I may ask for some help with it, I don't necessarily go in asking for it to be stopped. Do you know what I mean? It's right. a way of working with respect.
Very yeah. good. Well, let's talk about some of the legends, like King Arthur's Merlin or Aleister Crowley. What was the information you were able to uncover in your research and history?
Well, I was really fascinated by Merlin, you know, forever. And I've also been fascinated with Aleister Crowley for a long, long time. And I first wrote about him in Witchcraft magazine in the early 90s. And my very first tarot deck was the Crowley Toth deck. And I was really scared of them when I first got them. I was really quite unnerved by their power, the imagery, and really just this formidable feeling that they had. And I don't think I was ready to work with them when I first got them. And since that time, I've really been fascinated with Crowley. He's such a colourful character. You know, he's born at the end of the Victorian era, and to me he's like this human bomb that goes off that kind of had to blow through all the restrictions and the prudery and the kind of weird approach to sex, sexuality, spirituality that was taking place at that time. He was a law unto himself. He was kind of like an occult Oscar Wilde. He was an amazing poet and writer, but on a physical level, he was incredible. He was a mountaineer. He scaled some of the most formidable mountains in the Himalayas before anyone else. Any other white person, I should say. And he brought yoga to the West as well. And usually when people talk about Crowley, they talk about what a bad person he is and what an evil person he is. And you know, he was. He was not a good person. He was not the sort of person you would ever leave your kids with. He was not the sort of person you'd ever ask to look after your pets while you go away for a while. He was just not a nice guy, but he was a catalyst for change. And I'm really fascinated by the late 1800s, early 1900s, and this shift from this very prudy kind of outlook to a society where you have secret societies, occult influences just washing through British society. You have incredible amounts of people turning away from the church in the 1920s and turning to, you know, spiritualism essentially. And I think that's a post-World War I phenomenon with so many people losing their kids. You know, they turned to spirituality because, you know, that was a way of connecting with their lost kids. But I think there was this disillusionment taking place, and Crowley really epitomizes this turning away from convention. And he was bisexual. He was without any kind of scruples. And in many ways, that's an awful thing to be. It's not a good thing to be without scruples. But in other ways, having a person like this breaking all the rules pushes everyone else into a new place in the world. And to me, that's his force. He's just amazing. And I love to think of him, you know, he died penniless. He died, you know, probably still in recovery from his heroin addiction. He was a very, very wealthy young man. He was, an heir to a massive fortune from his family. They were brewers. And, you know, I'd wish there was a little bit more balance around discussing him, because in occult circles or through, you know, New Age or spiritual circles, if you bring Crowley up, you're kind of like, don't talk about him, he's evil. And it's like, but we kind of need to talk about him because he's real. He did a lot of amazing work. He did a lot of good work. We might not have yoga in the West if not for him. So he's a very shadows and light kind of human being, and he's a real person. He was also a spy during World War II. So he's this fascinating person who I think is really worthy of examination and looking at, and has left us with an amazing heritage to look at and a whole lot of examples on what not to do as well. You know, he was thrown out of Italy for his, well, it's too light to call it misbehavior, but for, you know, so many incidents that went on while he was living in Italy. But he really was this life force that I think pushed us out of the Victorian age and drew us all into an era where we began to question rules. And I also think people love a bad guy. They love someone to point the finger at and say, isn't he evil?
Right.
You know, they called him the wickedest man in the world. And we all love a person like that, don't we? Because if we can point the finger at someone like that, we don't have to examine any of our own demons because we're too busy, you know, seeing them externalized and embodied by someone else. So I think that finally people are able to talk about him a little bit more. And I wanted to include him in the book because I think he's an absolute worthy figure of note. He's a scholar. He's a poet. He's a remarkable human being who did amazing things, wonderful things, but who also did terrible things as well. And he deserves his place in magical history for sure. With Merlin, you know, I was much more sort of fascinated to explore, was there a Merlin? Is there a real historical personage called Merlin? Who are we talking about when we refer to him? He's almost become an archetype now. And archetypes can have energy depending on how many people are believing in that particular archetype. And I believe that archetype is coming through to us again and again throughout popular culture quite often. You know, that idea of Gandalf, for example, is not so far removed from that idea of Merlin. And we're again and again seeing his story or Merlin's story depicted throughout pop culture. But we do know that in the 4th century AD, that there was a chieftain who many years later in the 1100s was written about as King Arthur. And it's most likely that he had a kind of advisor, you know, a head druid who was Merlin, who would advise him on the right way to undertake ritual, when to undergo battle, the right protocols to work with, because druids were not only mystics, they were also the keepers of law, the deciders of when battle would take place. They had a whole range of responsibilities that were beyond the mystic. Or perhaps I should say, because the mystic was interwoven with everyday life, it wasn't as separated out as it is now, they were incredibly important people. And the chief druid for a whole period of time was also known as the Merlin. So it was a title as well. But I believe that there definitely was a chieftain, King Arthur, and that he absolutely had an advisor, a wizard, a wise person who worked with the elements and with energies and worked with the weather and various types of magic. And that is the being we now refer to in the main as Merlin. But it, you know, his legend, if you go to Wales, for example, in the United Kingdom, the people in Wales will say, Merlin's from here, he's from Snowdonia. And if you go to Cornwall, they say, no, he's from here, he's from Cornwall. And if you go to Somerset, they're like, no, he's from here. And if you go to the northwest of France, they go, no, he's from here. And if you go to Ireland, they will trump them all and say, no, he's from here. And not only that, he brought Stonehenge over to England. So you know, his legends are many, but we know that he is most likely to have been a chief druid who was the advisor to this chieftain who united the tribes against the Anglo-Saxons who were at that stage invading Britain.
That's intriguing. We've done some shows on the whole King Arthur legend and was this real? Did this exist at some point? Graham Phillips, I believe, was our guest on this, and he's really dipped deep into this history. So that's really kind of an interesting point that these characters may have existed at one point in a different form than we've grown to know and love them in literature, but that they may have actually existed. When you were doing this research, was there anybody you were surprised to find, aside from people like Winston Churchill, was there anybody else you were surprised to find kind of had this as part of their culture and lifestyle?
You know, I think I was really surprised by the Witch of Endor being in the Bible. That was something that really struck me as ironic, giving the statement within the Bible, you know, thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. And yet living within the Bible itself is the Witch of Endor. That really surprised me. There were also, you know, very ordinary people whose stories really deeply touched me. There was one little piece of information that I found regarding Salem that sort of set me on my own kind of quest, and that was finding out that within the court record, I found that there had been a set of chains and shackles made by the local blacksmith, but they had to be ordered specially because they were made for a four-year-old child. And that set me on the path of who were these made for? Who could possibly, as a four-year-old, have been shackled and chained in prison? And it led me to discovering this girl, Dorothy Good, who is in the court records. She's there, but I've just never really heard her spoken about. And her mother was Sarah Good. Her mother was executed, and Dorothy, who was only 4 years old, was imprisoned, and she was ultimately released. We don't know who paid her bail. After about 2 years, when everything died down a bit, and she was classed as insane. And so she would have been about 6 years old. She would have been through an awful lot. And whether she was insane or whether she simply had post-traumatic stress disorder because of losing her mum gave birth to a little girl, Mercy, in prison, and Dorothy had to look after her, you know, a four-year-old when her mother was executed. So the trauma really drew me in, and this sense of wanting to give a sense of the humanity of the people who were caught up in these historic events. And we know about them from dramatizations like The Crucible, you know, by Arthur Miller, which is such a beautiful depiction of the Salem witch hunts. But we know about other people, but I really wanted to find out about some of the more obscure people. One of the towns that really disturbed me when doing this research was a town in modern-day Germany called Würzburg, and something like 90% of the people within Würzburg were executed, were burnt. And the phenomena of witch hunts and witch crazes really interests me in terms of the psychology of people who are caught up in hysterica, right, who are really captivated by the idea of finding an external reason for misfortune. And the absolute, the belief that they're onto the right thing really scares me. So that kind of absolutism, I think, is something humanity really needs to look out for, because we can hurt each other dreadfully when we do this. When we make other people evil for any kind of difference, we're really at risk of becoming the devil ourselves, you know, or what people perceive to be the devil ourselves. Because to me, when you look at those histories of Würzburg, or if you look at the history of Salem, you're looking at a kind of possession that's innate within humanity. We have this within us to be quite, quite evil. And, you know, I find it really disturbing, and I think we still have it, no matter if we think we live in a rational world. I think we still have it within us, and we need to be aware of it. And so that really, those individuals, you know, I was very moved by them and very saddened by their stories, and I felt a great deal for them.
Do you believe in magic as it's portrayed you know, in literature and in, movies, you know, fiction, things like that. Does a real magic exist, or is it just nature science, you know, just the idea of our interconnectedness and the energy surrounding us? And it's nothing really magical. It's just knowing how to utilize energy.
I believe that there is magic. And for me, what magic is the intentional interaction and purposeful use of natural energy. You know, it's already available. Do you know what I mean? There are cycles of the moon. There are cycles of the sun. There are cycles of the seasons. There are all these energies out there. And it's like solar energy. You know what I mean? You put out your panels, you gather it in. And magic is the gathering in of those available energies, which most people are totally disconnected from, because I think that's kind of how our culture wants us as well. It wants us pretty disconnected. I believe that there is magic. How it's depicted in film and in literature is usually a very heightened example of what I would call magic. So that's my belief. But I do believe that you can interact with nature in such a way that you begin to pierce through veils, what I would call veils. So the kind of veils that separate worlds from worlds. So either the world of the present from the past and the future, or the world of humanity from the world of the trees or the animals. And you can take that further into the world of spirits or the world of those who've passed. And you can work with magic in order to connect or pierce those veils and work with other beings. And that is a little bit more like what you might see depicted in films. And you can feel energy gathering. You know, if you were to see, say, within a film, you know, someone gathering a ball of energy within their hands, well, you can actually feel that. You can actually develop that. I don't see it in the same way. I don't feel it in the same way. But having said that, I've seen some really extraordinary things and felt some very difficult to explain phenomena. And therefore, I don't poo-poo those filmic depictions or those literary depictions. I think sometimes they are a more imaginative depiction, but I think they're drawing upon something real, which is the gathering in of energy from natural forces. You know, when I believe in dragons, you know, I believe in fairies, I believe in mermaids, I believe in things that other people do not believe in. And that is because I've had interaction, and yet I don't see them in the way that they tend. You know, most of those kinds of beings tend to be depicted in a fairly, for example, you know, the fairies and mermaids are always depicted in a very humanoid kind of way, because that's how we understand them. You know, that's how we can recognize them. That's not how I see them. When I see them, I see them quite differently. But yes.
How do you see them when you see them?
I believe in magic. Yeah, I see them with my physical eyes, but I also see them with my spirit eye, or what would be called my third eye as well. So it's kind of like a weird interaction between my spirit eye and my physical eyes. And it's a strange way of seeing. It's a softening of the gaze, so that you're not looking hard at something, but you're looking beyond what seems to be there physically. You're able to see shapes formed and energy move. But it's something that, you know, it took place very, this is why I say, you know, as a young person, that was the kind of thing that was happening to me a lot. It's something that I work with now, but I don't try and work with it all the time, because I want to be able to drive my car. You know, I want to be able to, you know, be safe and be sensible and quite left-brained quite a lot of the time, because I'm naturally quite a right-brain person. I think that's, if you were to look at science, I think if a person was to work on entering into that right brain area and to work with that and to awaken that, they would begin to see what I see a lot more, because you begin to see the interconnectedness and the opening. It's, you know, like people who take certain chemicals in order to have certain experiences. They're opening up a part of the brain that, to people like me, or people who do a lot of this kind of work, it can happen naturally. You don't have to take what we call a mind-altering substance to do so.
Well, sorry, Tim, that ruins your weekend plans.
Boy, does it ever.
Well, I'm sorry, Tim. That's just not the way magic works, man. You don't need it coming from an ecstasy pill. Although I've seen some magical things happen when Tim takes ecstasy. It's amazing, Lucy.
Stop outing Tim.
Hey, he is my little nature maiden, and I can out him all I want.
Oh, my goodness.
Are there tools that, you know, I mean, people are so familiar with, cauldrons, with magic wands, with brooms, with all of these things associated with witches and witchcraft. When you look back at it through the histories, are there legitimate reasons for these connections to these things, or is it just Hollywood machinations?
There are legitimate tools, absolutely. You know, if you look at ancient books, you know, there's the Book of Invasions from Ireland, which was written down in the 11th century, but they could be over like 3,000 years old in terms of an oral history. There are the four great treasures of Ireland, and they include cauldrons, and they include staffs, they include spears and swords, you know, that are all impregnated with some kind of energy that is beyond its function. You know what I mean? So a cauldron becomes something other than just something to cook within. It becomes something which you can bring back a warrior from the dead. A sword will have an enchanted scabbard, so no blood will ever be drawn with it. You have wands that can separate worlds. You have all of these tools in the ancient writings. So they're legitimate tools. They're not sort of fancy dress. They're all really used. Like a broom, for example, well, there's several things going on with a broom, but one of the aspects of using a broom is to space clear or to sweep the energy, to clear a space with it. And you would use a particular kind of herb to make your broom so that you're clearing with a particular kind of herbal energy. So there's real reasons, real history, real use underneath what we see depicted. Certain potions and unguents were taken by what we would now call witches, and they would sweep with their brooms, and when they take these potions, they would fly. In other words, they would have altered consciousness. So sometimes, yes, things like fly agaric, a certain kind of mushroom, would be used to work with. You know, beneath all of these tools is something very real. And if you go to places like the British Museum, you see these ceremonial cauldrons that were not used in a functional way to cook with. They were used in a magical and ceremonial way. So they're real objects. And the ones that I work with, I have a cauldron that I've had for maybe about 25 years now. It sits by my fireplace, and I tend to use it only for magical purposes or ritual purposes. And only once did I use it to cook within, and that's when my actual stove blew up and I needed I needed to cook something. So I used my cauldron in a functional way. But to me, that was kind of magical too. It was like, see, electricity, I'm taking it back. I'm taking back the power.
You keep getting that flavor of I and Newt, which can really mess up a lasagna.
yeah, there was a little bit of an interesting flavor going on there. I have quite a lot of tools, and I try to use them appropriately. So, you know, they're not used necessarily on an everyday basis. They're used for ceremonial purposes. And as they're used, they not only work with the energy that they've accrued throughout their usage and the actual innate energy that they have, depending on what they're made from, they take on more energy each time they're used. So this is why passing on your magical objects to another person is quite a big deal. And this is where I think you have these legends of, say, an enchanted sword or an enchanted wand, for example, because they've been used so much, they've accrued a great deal of energy. And when they're passed on, they're kind of ready to go. You know, they're ready to work for whoever's hands they're within. So, yeah, these are real objects with real power.
before we wrap up for the day, what putting together a book like this and all the information and myths and mysteries behind it, what did you really want people to take away from this book and get for themselves?
I guess I didn't start with a kind of, you know, grand idea about what it could do for people. It really started with my own obsessions. So it began with my own obsessions, but as I was writing, what became clear was how brave these people were and how courageous they had been to do their work in much more dangerous times than the ones we live in now. And by the end of the writing process, what I really wanted people to take away was a sense of, if you have these inclinations, if you want to explore these things, you have a legacy of people who've suffered greatly for their beliefs and for their practices, and they've almost paved the way for you to now have the freedom and the safety to work with. Yes, you might get teased. Yes, you might be rejected by a few people. All of that might happen, but you are far safer now, in the Western world at least, than we ever were before. So we don't owe anyone in the past, but they've worked so hard to create a space for us to work within that our petty fears are really nothing more than our own insecurities, and we can push through those. And if we really want to live our own life, however that, you know, whatever form that takes, I think we have a duty to go forth and live as richly and fearlessly as we possibly can, because we enjoy these great freedoms that others have suffered for us to have. And that's what I would like people to take away, the courage to live their own lives. And that doesn't mean to be a witch or to be a wizard, just to live their own lives in whatever form it takes place. And to live beyond the constraints of organized religion and government.
Now, that's a message we can stand behind. This is great. How many different stories do you dip into? How many different legends and myths do you really try to uncover in this book?
I think there would be there's hundreds of people within the book, but there's a good 20 areas that I go into and work within, and it goes right up to the modern. Well, really, it goes up to the counterculture movement in the 60s, and to a degree to the modern day. So it begins prehistory, ends now, and it's not an exhaustive history. I want people to be really aware of that. It's not an exhaustive history. I'm not trying to provide an academic history of all of these people. I want it to provide human stories, so that we could all be really inspired and find the dignity and magic within our own humanity and live really, really free, really fearless, really rich and meaningful lives ourselves. Yeah.
You know what I like most is that even the good witches are fallible, Tim. You know, and they can be snarky bitches. And if you don't believe me, Glinda the Good Witch explains to Dorothy that the Wicked Witch was evil because she was ugly, then looks at Dorothy and says, "Are you a good witch or bad witch?"
Yeah.
That's kind of a backhanded compliment. You just got done saying bad witches are ugly.
You know, I don't like Glinda very much.
Who would?
She actually orchestrates everything. If you think about the Wizard of Oz, she orchestrates everything.
Yeah, she was kind of the Tony Soprano of Oz, right? She wanted to clear out Oz, so she sends Dorothy as kind of her minion to go forth and kill the other witch and get rid of the wizard and kind of return it to her territory. A lot of people don't see that strong arm of the story.
Glinda reigns supreme at the end. And I think what's a bit disturbing about that is Glinda appears to be such a lovely person. Mm-hmm. She appears to be so sweet. Nice, but I think she has a rather dark agenda.
Now, wait a minute, Tim. I'm looking at our guest, Lucy Cavendish, and she looks beautiful and sweet and nice.
Uh-huh.
Did she just reveal her hand to us?
Maybe.
Huh. Are you trying to tell us that
you're
shouldn't?
You're asking whether I'm...
Are you a good witch or a bad witch?
You should be very afraid. I think you should be very afraid.
Very afraid. Lucy, thank you so much for coming on and spending some time. And I know you've got a lot of other books. We'd love to have you back with us. And you don't even have to talk paranormal. You could just read the phone book to us, and we'd be happy to have you back here.
Oh, thank you so much. It's just been such a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it.
We appreciate it. Where can people find more information about you, Lucy, and about your books?
Well, if they go to www.lucycavendish.com.au, they'll find a very much in need of updating website with, nevertheless, all of my work there. So you'll get a good idea of what I'm about if you go there.
All right. We'll have a link up to the website and to the book so you can find it a little bit easier. Thank you all for tuning in. We've got more great shows lined up for you this week on the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
This Labor Day, say goodbye to spills, stains, and overpriced furniture with WashableSofas.com. Featuring Anabay, the only machine washable sofa inside and out, where designer quality meets budget-friendly pricing. Sofas start at just $6.99, making it the perfect time to upgrade your space. Anabay's pet-friendly, stain-resistant, and interchangeable slip covers are made with high-performance fabric built for real life. You'll love the cloud-like comfort of hypoallergenic, high-resilience foam that never needs fluffing, and a durable steel frame that stands the test of time. With modular pieces, you can rearrange any time. It's a sofa that adapts to your life. Now through Labor Day, get up to 60% off site-wide at WashableSofas.com. Every order comes with a 30-day satisfaction guarantee. If you're not in love, send it back for a full refund. No return shipping, no restocking fees, every penny back. Shop now at WashableSofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.